if I can get their info, really push them to get a meeting, and because I think we can help. I think that's the key. If people who aren't sales folks, and maybe even sales folks, they feel like you have to be pushy, and that's uncomfortable. But I think if you believe in what you're doing, which I certainly believe in, that we're super valuable to small businesses, you need to tell people that and ask if they want to meet and explain how you're valuable.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy, CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB's spending with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Kyle Smith from Strata Cloud Accountants, and Kyle has an interesting background, and we're going to talk about how he has built his own SMB accountancy and fractional CFO business out of the ashes of the ZIRP era. You might not remember the ZIRP era, the zero interest rate period when money was free and people with a good story and a deck could raise millions of dollars. So Kyle has a bit of a war story on the back of that, but thankfully there was a renaissance, so we're going to talk about that as well. But before we get into that, Kyle, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could just tell us something about you that not many people know.
I'm an ex-professional poker player.
Awesome. I'm very intimidated by professional poker players because I feel like you have to be super smart to do that stuff. Is that true? Are you great? Obviously, you're great with numbers, but how much brain power? How much is brain power? How much is human, whatever, understanding?
My ego likes to think that I'm smart, but I'm not playing poker anymore. Not for reasons I like to think, but it requires more than just brains, I would say. You have to have a certain fearlessness playing poker. You've got to have both fearlessness and brains and luck. Got to have all three of those in combination.
I follow the All In podcast, and they're always talking about gambling, and they're talking about how they want their kids to learn it because it helps them to understand risk and the game, the entire game, not just a hand and all that sort of stuff, which resonates. So my wife caught me playing poker with my nine-year-old the other day, and she wasn't very happy about it. I was trying to explain to her, oh, no, it's just for her development. But anyway, okay, cool. All right, very good. Yeah, all right.
Fan of the All In folks as well. We have a meetup group here in Austin that I didn't get to go to the last meeting, and I need to, but I agree. I'm going to teach my kids when they get older as well, because it's such a great lesson on risk that you can't teach any other way, in my opinion.
So what's the biggest takeaway? You think, why should people play poker, and what's your takeaway from doing it professionally in business?
Yeah, so I would recommend my route if you went the specific way I did, because my opinion is poker is a horrible way to make a living. It's a great game. It's a great game to know. And that's why, like I said, I would teach my kids, but I would not want them. They can do whatever they want to do, but I would not push them to being a professional poker player. It's a weird hours. Right. You have to be ready to play at any given time, and not really healthy. You're sitting there for hours and hours at a time. So it was not a good way to make a living, but it's an awesome game. It's a fun game to learn. So that's what I learned when I was playing, was that, hey, it's not what I want to do for a living, but it's a really fun game. It's a mind sharpener for sure.
Yeah, good for entrepreneurs. I got some entrepreneur friends around, and we do a two-hour game or whatever every couple of months. And it's just a good way. You can chat, perfect, and you can catch up, and there's something to do. Covers up the awkward silences, and you can still hang out.
Well, we'll have to chat after this, because I'll give you some tips to crush them.
Okay, awesome. So let's dial back then the clock a little bit to what I'm calling the ZIRP era. Your current business came out of I might be dramatizing that because my marketing juices are coming out, but like your current success has come out of a less auspicious start. So back in the ZIRP era, it was super easy to raise money, zero interest rate period. If you had a sales deck and a good story, you could sell future value before it ever existed. And I'm guessing that was your experience. Maybe tell us a little bit about what happened.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on the money. It's hard to create a successful business. Most times it doesn't happen. I don't know the stats, but I think it's 80% of businesses within the first 18 months or something like that don't make it. So it's not an easy road to travel. But yeah, we were in that period where our CEO was really skilled at making a good deck, making a good pitch, and he believed the vision. In another dimension, we might have gotten there. It's just in this case, we didn't get there in terms of what we were trying to do. What we were trying to build was accounting software, but the firm started as a traditional service-based accounting firm. And so I came on right in the middle of that transition from service-based to let's build a technology that can more or less replicate what we're doing on the service side. And we're just not there yet as a society. We haven't figured that one out. I think AI will make some leaps and bounds, but it'll still be advisory service. And what we do at our company now, Strata, is always going to be needed. And that transition period, we raised $100 million 12 months. But very quickly, the folks that gave us the money didn't see the progress. But at the same time, with that money, we were scaling the business very quickly. And I got to see 30 new clients a week for 18 months. And my job was, I was head of the onboarding team. So we would take in new clients. And most people who are coming to an accounting finance firm, their books are not in great shape. Not most, but a lot of the time, we're not getting people that have perfect accounting finance setup. So we're having to, they're all small businesses, medium-sized businesses. We're having to get them ready to go, get their books in good enough shape. And I got to see a ton of different businesses across industry and really get a crash course. And so when the product side didn't work out at that business, me and two other co-partners said, hey, let's continue to do what we're doing on the service side, because we were very helpful helping these businesses grow and helping them save money. And that's what started Strata Cloud Accountants.
Okay, so I was being a little bit harsh here, because they were obviously doing something right to bring in 30 new inflow, 30 new clients a week is insane. So what was the hook? Like, how were they managing to figure this out when lots of clients would be lucky, firms would be lucky if they could onboard one a week would be massive. What were they doing to achieve this?
Yeah, I think part of it's the messaging of, hey, this is what we're building. So there was a lot of buzz around, hey, we have $100 million and we're building an AI tool. We may not be there yet, but come on with us now, because we're at the cutting edge and we're replacing human labor with AI. And this was before ChatGPT, and I think before the boom in AI. So we were ahead of the curve on that one in the messaging. And then there was just a large dedicated sales team that was making calls 24/7, reaching out to folks. And there's lots of small businesses. If you're working that hard, you can get a lot of people. There was definitely folks in there that were not good fits for our business. I think just take a wide net, message that we're AI and have a lot of people doing that messaging. It's just a volume game at that point on the front end.
Okay, so you're losing money on every client, but you're making it up in volume, that old trick. But it doesn't really matter so long as you can find a bigger fool, right? If you can do your next funding round at your 100 million, you can get your 500 million, you get your secondary out, the VCs get their carry. That's what some people are calling a Ponzi scheme in VCs, the tide is going out a little bit now, especially at the end of 2024, when a lot of these firms are closing down, a lot of people people who came into that space who maybe shouldn't have been in the space. And it was really about just finding a bigger fool. The reference there being, in the stock market, all you need is someone else to believe what your story you're selling. And you're not actually delivering value. You're just, I don't know, I'm pretty cynical about this, but I'm like, you're not delivering value. Obviously, someone else might argue differently. Interesting. And I guess then cost. Okay, so those 30 clients a week, now I'm really interested. So anonymously, obviously, you must see a lot of different businesses. Did you see any business that you're like, whoo, this is good? These guys have it dialed in. Have you? What's the best looking business you have come across in that way, and what made it so attractive?
Yeah, one that I see even with our business now is like clinician-based firms and assisted living, because the money is very steady because it's coming from the state usually, whichever state you're in. And so the income is very steady and the demand is super high and the competition seems like it's pretty low. So if you put all three of those together, you have a model for a very profitable business month to month. So that would be, if I was taking the path of least resistance, that's what I would choose. But a product company that scales obviously can be massively profitable too, but those companies have to work on cash burn for a really long time, like you were talking about. That's the model of Scale Factor, where they were working, the company I worked at, they were working on a cash burn and didn't even come close to hitting that hockey stick and ramping to profitability. So to me, if you wanted something that could be profitable very quickly, it would be a service-based business like that, that you would have the revenue is super solid. It might be coming from a state source or some sort of really reliable revenue source.
Yeah. And now you see it with the silver tsunami, this thing we're hearing about all the time, aging population. It's only going to get more and more extreme. The only question is, will there be anyone around to be able to pay for it all? Which we won't go down that rabbit hole, but it's a big thing. I wonder if Elon's robots will be tucking me into bed at night by the time I get to that stage because there aren't enough people to service the need.
Yeah, I think there are enough people. It just, can we put them in the right spots? Because I don't know about you, but that seems like a horrible way to spend my last few years of life with a robot created by Elon. I'd much rather have a real person that, but it's like you said, it's that's an expensive proposition. I don't know. I don't know the future, but I know which one I'd rather choose.
I don't know. It's hard to know. I sometimes think, what happens if I end up like, whatever, you just don't know, like the last 10 years, maybe just put a VR helmet on me. I can relive my youth and the robots can change my diaper for me. And then it's less embarrassing. I don't know. We're going weird now, but maybe I'm getting older now. I'm getting the gray hairs and starting to think about this stuff, but it's a huge opportunity. No doubt about it. All right. Okay. That reached its natural progression at the end of the ZIRP era. There was no bigger fool. The interest rates went up. The people stopped investing. But you did something out of that is you worked with your team member there, right? So you learned that you were, hey, there is something here. So tell us a story about how you managed to transition into what you're doing now with Strata Cloud.
Yeah, we actually already had the idea when we were working at Scale Factor because they were moving so fast. And exactly what you described is what happened at Scale Factor. So they didn't care about profits at the beginning because the model was the Blitzscale model, which is the Reid Hoffman LinkedIn. He wrote a book about it. That model was basically revenue at all costs, take over the market, and then everything in profitability will take care of itself because then you own such a huge market share. So that was the idea when we were getting the initial funding. In the middle of getting the funding, the model, the kind of hip model among VC tech was unit level profitability. So our company responded to that by just removing headcount. So basically the company went to half size and that was the idea, is we got to get to profitability. So all of a sudden we went from let's scale out and revenue as much as possible to let's get unit level profitable. So that was a big transition. And in the meantime, we knew we were moving to software. So my partner and I, he pitched the executive team our idea of, hey, let's split the company into a service arm. We'll be ahead of the service arm. And then we can have the software arm and you can actually focus on the software because the company was software. On one hand, there was engineers trying to build the software. And then we had this whole other service line. And it's a tough business to have all those under one roof trying to grow at one time. It didn't make a lot of sense to us. So we said, hey, let's split off this service line and you guys can focus on what the VCs gave you money for, which is creating a product. And they liked it and we were going to do it. And then the VC pulled everything. And so the software side didn't continue. But we said, hey, we'll do what we said we were going to do. And we can take the clients that we're working with and continue to give them great service and the value and the return on investment that they are getting right now. We'll make that even better because we don't have the other shackles that were hindering us. And that's what started Strata. So we already had the idea and just, it was a natural progression at that point that we started with the clients we were working with and built out from there.
Great. So in a way, you had an unfair advantage to build out your company initially. You had that stock, if you like, of companies that were interested. Everyone needs an unfair advantage, in my view. That's a perfectly valid best way to start, I'd say, and got you up and running.
Poker for you right there. Sorry to interrupt. It's just a perfect example of, I said at the beginning, it takes luck, right? I had in my career, 5 times where I probably got unlucky. But you keep yourself in the right position, you can get to that spot where absolutely that was an unfair advantage to start the company. But things didn't go my way earlier on, and maybe they won't in the future, but you've got to stay in there and that one lucky shot will come. You got to take advantage of it.
Okay. You've been doing a lot of podcasts recently. I noticed you're on the Candy and Messers show, and you were talking there about how when you're dealing with a new client, you like to keep things simple and yet still introduce the measures that they need. So how do you get that balance right? There's a temptation to bury people in timesheets to try and eke out all their productivity, which is a sure way to get moved on, I think, pretty quickly because people realize they don't like fear. So what's your approach to getting the balance right between educating people financially about a business? And it's amazing how people can get to fairly significant scale with fairly limited understanding of their finances and then progressing them into a slightly more financially aware situation. What's your strategy there?
Yeah, like you said, I like to start simple. And as an example, we worked with a clinician firm that started with one person and they quickly scaled out to 30 employees and they didn't know what their margin was. For us, that we got to chop the biggest first. So that means let's find out what your gross margin actually is and then see if we can take action on it. In that case, we just set a revenue goal as a step one and then we separated out their variable clinicians with their salary staff, which was admin. And then that way we were able to get a gross margin that was accurate for them. And when we first started, it was break even. Their gross margin was break even. So then when you add in all the other costs, that's not a winning business. And at the same time, their revenue was lower than what they thought, just on their gut guess of what it should be month to month. And so what we were able to step one with them on the revenue side is, let's look at how many, what's the by clinician, how much are people generating? And if they're all lower than you expect, let's address that and find the actual number should be. And so they were able to go clinician by clinician, start tracking it. And they did start with a spreadsheet, which I don't like, but they were starting from zero. So sometimes you got to get in between. And so we'll start there. But they were then able to track it. That's the key, is tracking and then addressing. So they were able to move where they were break even. With you months, they were at 20% margin because they were able to identify their key players, the people that weren't performing, and make adjustments. So that's huge. And that's what start with revenue is usually what I do and go from there.
So yeah, there's often like what I call the air gap between finance and operations when it comes to understanding what's that. So and bridging that is typically that you use a hammer, use an ERP, or sounds like you were able to just do those figures on the back of a napkin, or how did you start getting the information you needed from the operation side to figure out that unit level economics?
Yeah, so we used a tool in that case called Spotlight, which is driver based, and it bolts onto QuickBooks. I'm a big proponent of that because Excel doesn't bolt on to your actual numbers. So I love systems that actually integrate with QuickBooks Online, which is 90% of our clients are on QuickBooks Online as small business. And so I was able to take what we basically sat down and I met with the owner, and she was saying, here's how, so I can build a driver-based model for revenue that is your clinician times the amount of sessions times the average price of the session for each clinician. And you can get as detailed as you want there, but you can also keep it pretty high level. And then you have a step one. Now we have a forecast, and we have a forecast that we can easily take actuals from for the rest of the costs from QuickBooks, populate that into our budget, and we already have a starting point. I'm able to take just the revenue from the client, and we can build out a whole budget, and then I can work with the client and say, here's the budget, let's tweak these cost items that we need to one by one. And now the client doesn't have to build the budget from scratch. I've given them a template, and we can quickly make some adjustments, and a big time saver because they don't have time to sit there for hours and create a budget.
Okay. Ding-a-ling-a-ling, you said the B word. So budget. I love budgets. You love budgets. Operations people hate budgets. Like what now? So how do you bring, because this is really where you're trying to bring the financial awareness of the business into the business itself, not just something that the accounts department do over there or whatever I see at the end of the month in my payslip. But this is how you're able to make the operations team part of the financial story, so they're aware. So I can understand how you can do a budget, cash flow forecast, do a nice spreadsheet. That's great. Sits on someone's computer somewhere, maybe in the cloud. But what's your approach for holding people account for those budgets or operationalizing the budget as I describe it?
Yeah, I think you need to involve people at least on a monthly basis and set the targets. And in a case where I'm working with a hospitality group, the general managers are responsible for certain metrics that are built from that budget, and they need to hit them on a month-to-month basis at risk of their bonus getting docked or moved to another quarter. And we preach that the bonus pool itself, it's not all about bonus, but the company is more profitable if we're making these measurements. Just last month, we had a meeting where one of the GMs was literally focused on one metric in one store for one product. And their goal was to bring the cost up to a 90% efficiency, and it was at 78. They brought it up to 90, and so I was able to call that out and say that was an extra $5,000 in profit just that location. And so that's an extra $5,000 to the company. That's more money bonus pool, and that person is now in line to get a promotion. So I like producing those type of incentives for people to focus on, and we're looking at it once a month. And in that case, we're meeting as much as two in between to make sure that we're on pace. But I think that's the thing, is really in part to that this is important because it means more profit. And that's why we're in business.
Interesting. So that comp plan is interesting. So you have operations people who aren't necessarily like salespeople who can comp salespeople easily enough. But if you have a pool, so this is something that's designed to, it sounds like everyone gets a piece of how it works. So there's a pool there, and then you're working as a team. And do you tell them how much is in the pool, like week by week or month by month, or do you find out at the end of the quarter?
Yeah, month by month, we're letting the GMs know how we're doing and where the pool stands. And once again, we're saying, hey, it's not all about bonus, but this is just one other incentive to perform. And like you said, it's easier with sales. Operations is harder because there's more nuance on what they can control and what they can't. But we just, in that case, we're more honest with it. Hey, we know you can't control this piece of the business necessarily. And we know that all ports, in this case, all segments of the business are related. So our bonus plan isn't island-based, meaning it's not just like how you do at your location. It's a pool. It's a company-wide pool, and it's split by revenue of each segment. So then they're incentivized to take a step up and try to help the entire business instead of just, hey, I just need to focus on my thing that I'm responsible for exclusively. So we wanted to incentivize people to think more for the business as a whole. And that's the way we set that one.
My fear with these incentive programs is sometimes is what's a bonus this quarter suddenly becomes a pay cut next quarter if you don't keep it up. So let's say business doesn't do that, or you figure out for business reasons that incentive program was set up wrong, or suddenly people get used to that bonus pretty quickly. And it, my opinion, it's easy to lose value in it, right? So you think, oh, that's, you just expect it to come. So has that been your experience, and how would you mitigate that if you had to?
Yeah, it's really tough. And the example I gave, it's the bonus initially was just store-based. So each store got the bonus, and there was one store that was outperforming the others. And so that team was very dependent on that bonus. The first key is flexibility. So we said, hey, we're switching the plan. We're going to get the team that's overperforming, we're going to get it so you're as close as you could be to where your bonus was, but it's going to be a little bit lower. And the reason is because you are actually getting the benefit of the other store's work. In this case, there was a commissary, and the commissary folks weren't getting any piece of that bonus that this other team was getting. So it was a tough conversation. Luckily, I didn't have to have it. It had to be done if we were going to change incentives and let people know that, hey, this just thinking about your bonus is a little bit myopic because the company's growing and your store's performing well. So you have a ceiling to work within the company to move up to different positions as you progress your career. So that was one, is resetting. It's just not about bonus. And then two, making sure that when we roll out the bonus plan, because change management is hard, saying this is discretionary. So here's the framework. We basically make the framework flexible so you can change it going forward, because the last thing you want to do is have those difficult conversations and then you blow up what you created the next quarter and you start over again. And then people are like, here we go. And then they throw their hands up. I think you really, to do something like that, you have a shot to change it. And so change it with a nice wide framework where you can make little adjustments in the future without having to blow up the entire thing.
Yeah. Anytime I roll out an incentive program, I make it very clear, this is the last time this incentive program will ever exist. There may never be another one again. So make hay while the sun shines, and we'll see what happens next quarter. So that's my, and of course, no one believes me. They still expect something next quarter. But anyway, we'll worry about that later. Okay, very good. I think this is the sort of thing where, you know, a fractional CFO really comes in, that you've seen this rinse and repeated number of different businesses. People are largely the same. You guys start to build up that muscle memory of how these things actually go. And this is the tacit knowledge you just can't get normally from a book or a blog or whatever. It's like people, is a lot more subtle than that. And you can carry across like the experience across multiple businesses, which I think is really important. Great. So from here then, we've talked about sales teams, and what are the other, you've got a couple of things to watch out for here. I have in our notes is that you like to look out for negative liabilities in a balance sheet. Maybe just chat a little bit about some bad smells. In programming, we have this thing called code smells. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's like something when you look at it and you go, that's not right. It's called a smell, and you're trying to avoid it. Now, I think you've identified, we had a couple of smells when it comes to the balance sheet you don't like, right? So let's talk about them. So what's a negative liability, and why is it a bad idea on your balance sheet?
Yeah, and the way to frame this, if there's finance accounting folks listening in, they already know probably what I'm going to say. So at the framework, or maybe not, but the framework was when I'm teaching non-accountants or business folks that don't have the accounting knowledge, red flags, and what the balance sheet is. This is a big one to help them understand it. And the way I explain it is the balance sheet is what you have and how you got it. And because most people are super intimidated by the balance sheet, not non-accountants, non-CFOs, non-finance folks, they're super intimidated. And so I say I'm intimidated. I stare at them 8 hours a day. So the way I like to reframe it is always what I have. If I'm looking at a balance sheet, it's what you have or what the business has and how they got it, right? So if we're talking about negative liabilities, a liability would be a loan, for instance. So a lot of times what happens with negative liability, so I tell folks, if you see negative numbers on a balance sheet, that's a red flag. And you should start asking questions. Even if you know nothing about a balance sheet, ask that question to somebody. If it's maybe it's a business that you're looking to buy, that would be a red flag. And you should be asking that business owner, why is this negative? There's no such thing as a negative number on a balance sheet. It should be reclassed. If there is a negative number, it should be moved. So a negative liability, when we see that in QuickBooks, for example, if a client's using QuickBooks, that usually or could mean that they had a loan that funded. So the bank gave them the money for the loan, and somebody, maybe it was the business owner, maybe somebody on the executive team or an accountant, however, and maybe this was years ago when the business was totally different. They could have qualified that and categorized it as income. It was just cash in. And a lot of times in QuickBooks, you just see an item come in on the bank feed and you say, oh, okay, it's revenue. And at the same time, maybe you got a bookkeeper down the line and they saw that there's a loan amount coming out every month and they'll start classifying it against a liability account. And so what's happening then is you might current year or prior year when you got that money in from the bank, that's revenue. So now your income statement, your profit and loss statement looks way better than it actually is. And then you have less liabilities too, and you're paying down a note that doesn't exist on the balance sheet. So that's a big one, a red flag that I say to folks who are non-accountants. A lot of the time, if you see a negative liability, double check that there wasn't a big chunky loan that came in and it got moved to revenue instead of put as owed back to the bank, which it should have been.
Yeah. Okay. I had to laugh here because in our quarterly board meeting, I have three of us who are non-accounting background and one with an accounting background. We always do this thing where we do the income statement and we're all over that. We know what that means. And then we have this pause and we say, okay, now it's time for Ronan to talk about the balance sheet. And he says some stuff and we like wait for it to be over. And then we're like, okay, great. Now let's go on and on to the next thing. So I get that totally. Okay. Another thing to look out for are large numbers on the accounts receivable side. So what's going on there if that's happening?
This is where QuickBooks comes in handy if you can run a balance, because a balance sheet is a snapshot and a balance sheet tells a story. That's exactly the reason I'm so passionate about the balance sheets, because even though you shut down when you hear the name, it tells the story of the business better than the profit and loss statement does, in my opinion, in a lot of cases. And this is a key example. So your profit and loss statement could look great, but then on the balance sheet, your receivables balance, and like I said, a balance sheet is a snapshot in time. If you look and you see the receivables balance growing from 1 year to the next or 1 month to the next, that's a big red flag, because that means you're recognizing revenue and you're not collecting on it. And the balance is getting bigger and bigger. So once again, it's a situation where if you looked at the profit and loss statement, it doesn't tell the whole story. But if you look at the profit and loss and then look at the balance sheet and your receivables balance continuing to grow, that means that you're booking revenue and you're not collecting cash. And that's a big problem in the long run. There has to be an explanation for it. And there certainly could be a legitimate explanation, but you should be asking. If I was in that board meeting, I would be asking if I saw something like that, because that's problematic that you're not collecting cash.
Okay. I understand it. Yeah, I had that years ago when I was a contractor and I was like fishing out the invoices, and they were like, and then it becomes a tax problem, right? Because you're supposedly getting that revenue, you don't have the cash, and then tax year comes around and that's a problem. And revenue don't like it if your revenue is what we call tax over here in Ireland, or the IRS.
Sure, it's IRS,
If you just can't start issuing credit notes to fix it because they think issuing too many credit notes, and then that's suspicious. And all right, very good. Okay, we've exhausted my accounting knowledge on that now, so don't worry. We won't go any deeper, but I think it's good to hear you explain. So let's finish up here with briefly, you've talked about how you've built your own practice through networking. So for someone who's building their own practice, what has been your approach? Just go beyond. You had a good head start, but how have you grown up beyond that?
Working? Yeah. So the head start was actually a little bit of a hindrance in this case, because we, at least for me, I feel like I got complacent because we had that kind of built-in business at the beginning, and I didn't get a real sense of what it took to grow a business. So I feel like I'm behind a few years on that, and now really realizing what I've learned is consistency is key. Go to those networking events. And if you're what I call a grinder, or somebody else gave me that term, but I'm an accountant, a CFO by trade. So I'm used to grinding it out, doing the actual work. And you've got to set that aside and really put your networking hat on, your business development hat on. And so the key to that is you don't get the immediate results like you do if you're doing the work. It takes time. So be consistent with what you're doing. Just network a lot of events. And then I've learned that you have to follow up. So if I go to an event on the networking side and I give my business card out to a bunch of people, I've never had somebody, maybe other people are better at it than I am or lucky or something, but I've never had a person reach out back to me directly to for us to work together. I need to follow up with them. I'm looking for folks that will be a good fit that I think we could be valuable for. And then if I can get their info, really pushing to get a meeting, and because I think we can help. I think that's the key. If people who aren't sales folks, and maybe even sales folks, they feel like you have to be pushy. and that's uncomfortable. But I think if you believe in what you're doing, which I certainly believe in, that we're super valuable to small businesses, you need to tell people that and ask if they want to meet and explain how you're valuable. So that's the two things, be consistent and then follow up.
Yeah, that reminds me of sometimes we'll have a sales guy and he's, I had no sales last week. And you're like, how many people did you ask for the sale last week? And that might be the answer as to why you're not getting the sales. So very good. That's a good tip. I love it. So to wrap up here, maybe you could just tell us two things. One, how can people get in touch with you? And B, who is your business hero and why?
Sure. Our website is stratacloudaccountants.com. And so we've got a ton of resources on there, free resources. Got a KPI, a downloadable KPI sheet as well, so people can get started. And what I like to say is 30 minutes a month is all it takes. And you'll get a lot of benefit from that, no matter who you are as a small business, especially if you're not looking at your numbers right now. Just spend 30 minutes a month and you get a ton of marginal return on that 30 minutes, I believe. And then, so once again, stratacloudaccountants.com. And then my business hero is my dad. He taught me everything I knew. I was a very scared kid coming out of college and got to work with him and the company that he was starting at the time and learned everything I knew at that time. And so it was amazing to be able to have that experience.
I think that's the biggest thing. I have entrepreneurs in my family, and it just, if you see your parents do it, it just gives you saying, well, I've got 90% of their genetics or whatever, 49 or whatever, but a lot of their genetics. So if they do it, then surely I can do it. And I love that idea. Even if I think of my kids today, you can tell them what you want, but if you show them, they learn by seeing what you do, not saying, listening to what you say. So I love that. Have you told your dad that he is your business hero?
I haven't told him directly. No.
Okay.
No.
Man, that's a good excuse to send this podcast to him and he can find out for himself. Good one.
Yes.
All right, we've done something good here today, if that's the only thing to come out of it. All right, Kyle, thank you very much. And thank you, listener, for getting this far into the podcast. You've been your special reward for your perseverance and interest in us as people and humans is being able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. If you're a fractional CFO yourself, you are passionate about KPIs just like Kyle is, and you're looking for ways to introduce budgets in a way that will actually stick, especially in businesses which are purchasing heavy, that do a lot of purchasing, we've got the tool for you. It'll stick right on top of QuickBooks. You don't need to buy an ERP. It's a very concrete way to deliver customer value quickly while sending them all 10 minutes home early, sending them home early by 10 minutes by taking the hassle out of managing their spend. So wow, that was slick. It's not like I haven't done that before. Anyway, that was great. Thanks, Kyle. I really appreciate this podcast. It was a good one. Thanks for coming along.
It was awesome to chat with you, James.